My name is David George Gordon, and I'm here to dispel the notion that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Because we're going to be talking about insects as food, why that's a good thing, and we're also going to be handing out samples at the end of the program. So if you didn't get enough at breakfast and you can't wait till lunch, this is going to be your big salvation moment. How many of you have eaten a bug before? Exactly. You've all eaten bugs before, whether you know it or not. And that's because there are bugs in a lot of our everyday foods. So things like tomato ketchup, for example, or any of the processed foods. When they squish all those tomatoes to make ketchup, they're going to get some bugs in there. Same thing is true with jams and jellies and peanut butter. The Food and Drug Administration has actually set allowable limits for the numbers of bugs that can be in certain foods. And based on those allowable limits, they figured out that there can be as many as 57 bug parts in a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Oh my God.
That's okay. So we've all been eating bugs, whether we know it or not. We're all still alive to tell about it. My favorite is there are bugs in chocolate. And someone actually did a study. You know, someone does a study on everything. They did a study for which chocolate has the most bugs in it. Do you know what the winner was? Reese's peanut butter cups.
Oh my.
Now, is that going to make anyone stop eating Reese's peanut butter cups? I didn't think so. Because I'll tell you something, the bugs that are in there are actually the best part of the candy. When you eat candy, what are you getting? Sugar, artificial flavoring. Sometimes they put wax in chocolate. Not so good. You eat too much on Halloween, you get a stomach ache or a trip to the dentist. If you're eating bugs, you're getting all sorts of good stuff. You're getting vitamins and minerals. You're getting lots of protein. They say pound for pound, dried grasshoppers are about the same as lean ground beef. And considerably less fat. So, yeah, pound for pound. If you want to go and get a quarter pounder from McDonald's or eat a quarter pound of grasshoppers, the choice is yours. And we have a wonderful representation in the back there, that beautiful painting of John the Baptist. We're talking about the world's most famous bug eater, right? Lived on locusts and honey. Honey, by the way, we all love honey, but it's basically bee barf. So, ooh, yuck, I'd rather eat the bee barf, but I don't want to eat the bees themselves. Where is that at? You know, go figure. So I'm going to take you on a trip I call Adventures in Entomophagy. And entomophagy is the fancy word for bug eating. So when you go home after your stay here in Holden Village, and people say, well, what did you do? You don't want to just say, well, I ate a bug. That sounds kind of rednecky. You want to say, I engaged in entomophagy. Then everyone will say, oh, really, did you now? And then you can say, yes, that means I ate a bug. Okay, the subtitle of this talk, I like, waiter, there's no fly in my soup. Okay. Now, when we're talking about eating bugs, we're not talking about this. These are the cockroaches every Thanksgiving. We're talking about cultures that actually eat insects. Come on in. I think those of you who attended my talk on cockroaches in human culture know this is a diorama done by Richard Boscarino, who's from where else? New Jersey. Okay, we're really talking about this.
Oh.
Did I hear somebody yell, yum? That's right. This is in Cambodia, where tarantula spiders are considered a delicacy. And, you know, we like to think that these other countries where they eat bugs, they're so poor and starving that they have to eat bugs. Well, that's like saying we're so poor and starving that we have to eat oysters on the half shell. These are comfort foods or delicacies. They're a part of the culture's values. They're comfort foods. Basically, whatever you grew up with, your parents served it to you. You think, or your grandparents served it to you, think that's a comfort food. Everybody should have oxtail soup, just like Uncle Al used to make. Or pickled pig's feet, like Mom and Dad used to eat while they watched the Super Bowl, right? That's a comfort food for you. These are comfort foods for them. We should also mention that people in this culture, these cultures, eat all sorts of weird stuff, but we don't think it's weird. I mean, chicken eggs, for example. Where did they come from? That's right, the butt of a chicken. Do we think that's weird? No, we all have eggs for breakfast. That's the way we were raised. If I said, tomorrow we're all having iguana eggs for breakfast, some of you would go, ooh, yo, gross. yuck, because we're not used to that. That's not part of our culture. I can just imagine someone, two cavemen sitting around going, see that bird over there? Let's rip off its feathers and eat it. And the other guy says, no, let's wait and see what comes out of its bottom first. And you know, Swift, author of Gulliver's Travel, wrote, he was a bold man who at first ate an oyster. So I'm going to ask you all to stretch a little bit. How many of you are adventurous eaters, by the way? Raise your hand if you like trying different foods. Go to a restaurant, you might order something you never had before. How many of you are really picky eaters? Like, you know, your parents said, all you wanted was cheese pizza growing up, and your parents were going, I can't let these guys eat anything. Peanut butter and jelly, but it's got to be strawberry because I don't do grape jelly, you know? Scientists are baffled by this. They kind of don't really know how to explain why some people are so picky and some people are not. There are two major theories. One has to do with culture. In other words, if you were exposed to lots of unusual foods as a kid, your chances of eating from a broader spectrum as an adult are certainly out there. I was reminded, by the way, in the store, they have postcards. Check them out by Ashley Brilliant, one of my favorite people. And Ashley Brilliant has a card that says, my strange behavior as a child is easily explained. I was practicing to become an even more strange adult. So if you had, that's the one theory. If you had a broad diet as a kid, you're going to have a broad diet as a grown-up. But the other theory, which certainly holds a lot of validity, is that there are some people who have more taste buds on their tongue and in their mouth than others. And we call those super tasters. Those are people who really, you know, oh, black pepper, I thought we were using white pepper. You know, they really have this fine, it's like a wine connoisseur or a perfume snob. People who really can taste their food. If you came from a region where there are lots of food choices, let's say you're raised in the tropics, lots and lots of different kinds of fruits and vegetables, then it pays to be a super taster. You know, you want to really know exactly what it is you're eating. But if you came from an area like I did, northern Russia, where the choices are limited, and sometimes the food wasn't exactly fresh to go with a potato that you had every day, then it did not pay to be a super taster. It actually is better to just wolf your food down and not even worry about what it tastes like. So that also explains why some people might be a little more finicky about trying new foods. This is a photograph from a five-course bug banquet that I hosted last September in Seattle. $20 a ticket. These folks are actually enjoying themselves, despite what it may look like. And this was called the Feast of St. Gratus. To tie this all up, for people who don't know St. Gratus, he's the patron saint of insect fear. Yes, there's a patron saint for everything, isn't there? And his big claim to fame was he actually saved a village in France by turning back a swarm of locusts. Locusts, by the way, and other insects are the only animals on our planet that are in direct competition with people for food. Think about it. That's kind of amazing. So eating them, particularly if you're an agronomist, if you're a farmer, eating bugs is kind of like sleeping with the enemy. We don't like that. And you'll find that European nations and their colonies, that would include Canada and the United States, they're the countries that are pretty much opposed to eating insects. Even though in the Bible it says quite explicitly that locusts are kosher. So all the rest of the cultures around the world, we're talking about South America, Africa, Australia, Mexico, Southeast Asia, China, all these other cultures are merrily munching away at some kind of bug. That's their thing. We're kind of the weirdos because we don't eat them. And by the way, I'll be doing another feast for all of you who just go, this just got me interested, and want to come to Seattle for the Feast of St. Gratus. It'll be September 7th. Getting ready already, starting to put in my orders. This is a menu. It's not from the Feast of St. Gratus. This is a menu that was written in the 1880s by Vincent M. Holt. He was a pamphleteer. Wrote a small book called Why Not Eat Insects? Why not indeed? And he was arguing, he's British, he was arguing that there are all these poor people who aren't getting good balanced diets. I can see Kari is studying this menu. She's thinking, we should try this at home. Okay. These are all This is his idea of helping poor people get through poverty. So this, he also created these very fanciful and exorbitant menus and had a few recipes in there as well. This is the 1880s, mind you. And, you know, here I am today kind of going, well, why not eat insects? That idea did not get a lot of traction over the last, whatever that's been, 70 years. But if you're looking for a stag beetle larva on toast, or gooseberry creme with sawflies, this is the man to go to, Vincent Pulse. You can find this online because it's copyright free, of course, so I'm sure Google Books has Why Not Eat Insects. Here's my book, which is not copyright free. And this book is I encourage people, this is where I veer into the infomercial, I always encourage people to buy this book. I know they have copies in the store at Holdenville. And I always tell people, if you buy this book and give it to someone as a gift, chances are good that they will not say, oh no, not another bug cookbook. And this one has 33 recipes in it for cooking with everything from teeny tiny ants all the way up to big tarantula spiders. When I started this book, it was actually one of the easiest of the books that I've written to sell to a publisher. It was almost surprising. It started out as an email to my agent. My agent forwarded it on to a couple of publishers, asking, this is what he's up to next. And there was like a bidding war over this book, which was kind of exciting. It's what every author wants, a bidding war. But they said, you have to come up with 30 recipes before we can publish this. We have to have some proof that you have 30 recipes. Well, I started writing a list, because at that point I had probably about 8. And some of them were just totally fanciful and began as bad puns, like pesto. All of you from the Midwest will appreciate this 3D salad. So there are some in there that were actually just bad puns, but there were a lot of them that were based on actual cultures from around the world. You know, at that point, and we're talking about a time, 1998, before the show Fear Factor or Andrew Zimmern's Bizarre Foods or any of those kinds of programs, around the world, gross out eating kind of shows. So most of what I was drawing on was scientific literature. There's a really big, fat, and boring book called Insects as Human Food, written by and published in Israel, of all places. There's another one, I really like this title, because at least the author tried a little bit to make it more user-friendly. It's called Butterflies in My Stomach. So the whole notion of putting those recipes together was kind of a challenge for me. And I'd never written a cookbook before, so I kind of went, oh gee, how hard can that be? I'll just knock out these recipes, I'll have it done in 6 months, and sit back and let the royalties roll. Well, 6 months turned into about a year and a half. Writing recipes, if you haven't done it before, is really difficult. There are all sorts of protocols about how the ingredients have to be presented, in what order they're presented, and what measure units you're using, and how specific you want to be. Is it butter, or is it salted butter, you know, there's all this stuff. In fact, there's a whole book called Recipes into Type that I wound up referring to in that. So it was a long process, but I emerged from this process as, I would say, if not the world's, and certainly North America's authority on edible insects. Any book that I write involves a lot of research, and I become one of those, remember those ads from the old comic, back to the comic books, learn to play the guitar in 30 days? Well, I could learn to become an expert on anything in about a year, basically, by researching it thoroughly like that. So ask me about elephants sometime. I put a lot of energy into researching Asian elephants at one time and traveled with elephant keepers. That's a great way to become an expert. Let's take a look at some of the recipes. Well, here are the ingredients, of course, artfully spread out. But one of my favorite parts of working on this book was working with a food photographer. Well, it was favorite and awful because it would take enormous amounts of time. They actually use stand-in food. So the lettuce doesn't wilt under the lights. It's sort of like body doubles. And then you bring in the real food to photograph it. And after an entire day of photography, we had captured like 2 recipes. And the photographer would go, now we're really cranking away. You know, he's like, he's all excited about it. I'm like, 2 recipes? We're going to have pictures of 8 of them. So it was really fun working with him. I want to show you some of those pictures. The very early editions of the book had these color pictures, and then I think the publisher, after about, I mean, we're talking about a book that's been in print for almost 15 years, so after about 6 editions, they decided to save some money and leave out the color plates. So if you find an early edition with color plates, grab it, or better yet, mail it to me. Here's one of the recipes. These are grasshopper kebabs. I call this sheesh kebabs. And grasshoppers seem to be sort of the coin of the realm. Lots of cultures eat grasshoppers. Native Americans used to work cooperatively. We think of them all, you know, from Dances with Wolves as driving the herds of buffalo around, but they also drove the herds of grasshoppers around. They'd actually dig a pit in the middle of a field, light a fire, let it go down to ashes, and then work cooperatively to drive the grasshoppers into this ash-filled pit, which would basically roast the grasshoppers. The grasshoppers would hop in, but they would not hop out. The grasshoppers I'm using here are actually these black ones with the yellow stripes. I believe those are Rocky Mountain lubber grasshoppers. They're quite large. There's not a lot in this picture to give you scale, but we're talking about 2 to 3 inch long bugs. Very theatrical. In Mexico, they use really small grasshoppers called chapulines. Have any of you had those? You go to Oaxaca, you can get chapulines. You can have empanadas. Actually, I say go to Oaxaca. You can go to Los Angeles and get these grasshoppers at Oaxacan grocery stores or restaurants. They're quite delicious. They're very small, and of course we're talking about less body armor just by the fact that they're youngsters. But they're immature grasshoppers. They don't have their wings yet. I should also point out, by the way, that locusts are basically flying grasshoppers. They have bigger wings. That's really the major difference right there, aside from their behavior of swarming. So these are a little more theatrical and a lot more crunchy than the ones you'd have in Mexico. In Thailand, I've seen people using grasshoppers and katydids, large stuff like that, and quite delicious. They have those barbecued on skewers on the streets. You can go out to a street vendor and get your locusts right there. This is a Thai-inspired dish. It might be hard for some of you to see in the back. This is giant water bugs on watercress. Lovely photograph. The water bugs themselves are considered a real delicacy throughout Southeast Asia because they have a taste that's very unusual. They have long muscles along their sides. You know, meat is basically muscle, whether we're talking about a pig or a cow or a lobster. We're talking about eating the meat, which is the muscle. And these have very long muscles. They're aquatic insects, so they sort of swim their way through the water. In the States, we call these toe biters because they also have big muscles for working their pincers. And if you're in a watering hole, you can find smaller ones. The legend is they'll come up and bite you on the toe. But those long muscles have a very distinctive flavor. It's almost like gin or something like that. It's an aromatic hydrocarbon. Hard to describe, but you know how gin has sort of a flavor to it as well as a taste while you're drinking it? It's because of those really large molecules that are airborne. They're the ones that fly around in the air. Pheromones are aromatic hydrocarbons, for that matter. And these have a very distinctive flavor. I like them a lot. I've discovered you can buy these giant water bugs in the frozen food sections of some Asian grocery stores. Kind of interesting. So if you want to try them yourselves, go to a Thai grocery, march your way to the back, and not only will you find giant water bugs, but you might also find things like ant pupa, the little, kind of the eggs, if you will, of ants in packages, and silkworms as well. So lots of bugs in the frozen food sections. I don't see them in Seattle, but I see them in Los Angeles and a lot of other cities I visit. It's kind of funny there. These are the native water bugs, and these are much smaller. The giant water bugs that we're talking about are probably about 4 inches long. And when you see them in a market in Thailand, it actually looks like they're selling, what do they call those? Stuffed grape leaves, domates. Big, big bugs. They're about the same color. Scorpion scallopini, that's another recipe that I invented before I actually tried it by the title. It just sounded good. But this is scorpion scallopini. We're using desert hairy scorpions. If you go to China, I know I keep citing China, that's like the bug-eating capital of the world. If you go to China, you can go to a restaurant and actually order a plate full of scorpions. And they use much smaller scorpions with the stingers still on them. There's supposed to be a medicinal value to that. I'm using really large ones, again, mostly for the theater of it all, not so much for the culinary benefits. And I take the stingers and the venom gland, which is on the tip of the tail, I remove that. So basically, this recipe is very similar to soft shell crab. And like a lobster or a crab, the muscles are mostly in the claws and the tail. That's the good eating part. The body itself is sort of like a lobster's body. You can eat it, but a lot of people prefer not to. Yeah, this recipe was called Ample Drumsticks. And I explain in the text that if you live in a household where everyone at Thanksgiving is fighting over who gets the drumsticks, well, this is a giant centipede from Central America. So you get at least 80 of those drumsticks. The Los Angeles, their alternative paper, I'm trying to think of this, LA Weekly, ran this photograph once when I was speaking down there, and their caption was, "Ooh, Brussels sprouts." And last but not least, these are fried green tomato hornworms. Any of you have tomato hornworms in your garden? Well, they're an east of the Cascades thing. I actually had someone go to an organic garden in Leavenworth, Washington, and harvest out all their tomato hornworms, so I could then bring them back to me so I could use them in this recipe, kind of reminiscent of Fannie Flagg's Whistle Stop Cafe fried green tomatoes. And they're pretty tasty. So when you see a dish like this, there's a great dialogue that goes on between your eyes, your brain, and your stomach. And your stomach will go, "Are you sure we're supposed to eat this?" Because, you know, let's face it, a long green thing looks like Martian food or something that might make you sick. So your stomach's visceral reaction is kind of like, "I don't know, let's have a reality check here. Brain, what do you think?" And the brain says, "Oh, go ahead, it's good for you. It's rich in protein and calcium, all that stuff." And then your stomach goes, "Well, I don't know." And if you have that dialogue for too long, you get sick, right? I always like to joke that your stomach has veto power. Your brain can tell you as much as it wants, but if your stomach ain't buying it, veto, up it comes, right? You don't like it. And that's an interesting thing when we talk about cooking, and you get a little chance to try this today. If you're actually looking at a bug and it's looking back at you, we're not used to that. We don't eat cool chickens. You know, the head is lopped off and all that. When you go to a Chinese restaurant, you order a whole fish, everyone sits around kind of like, "Oh, what do we do with that?" Until the waiter comes over and serves it for you, because we're used to seeing fillets shrink-wrapped and sold in the store. And the idea of eating a whole insect is difficult for that dialogue between your brain and your stomach. A lot of these recipes are much more palatable if, for example, you take mealworms, put them in tempura batter, and deep fry them. You're not looking at the mealworm, you're looking at these little things that look like puffs and taste like McDonald's French fries, but only if you put a lot of salt on them. That seems to be McDonald's secret of success. Okay. Well, since the book came out, and that was quite some time ago, I've just been traveling around the country. I knew this book would get a lot of attention when it came out, but I had no idea that 15 years later, I'd still be getting interview requests and invitations to do some cooking. 2 weeks ago, I was in Times Square at Ripley's Believe It or Not, right on the street there. Talk about a weird bunch of people, Times Square. With everyone who, people came up to me, "I'm from New Jersey, here we go." You know, they're like really proud. And then had some people from Columbia who were going, "Oh, ants, a delicacy," you know. And all these different people right there in Times Square trying bugs on the street. But I also do a lot of kids' programs. I do, in case you couldn't guess, I also do school assemblies and things like that. I go off on trips. I'm doing an event in upstate New York on the 4th of July called Buzz Fest. Just love that name. And it's kept me really busy. It's actually become a sideline. I now have my own freezer in our house and my own set of shelves to put my ingredients and things like that. So we're getting serious here. Last year, in Los Angeles, they actually had a bug cook-off with other bug chefs. You're saying, "Other bug chefs? You mean there's more than one?" Well, since my book came out, I've had a number of people, well, three of them in this photograph, have actually come up to me at cooking demonstrations and go, "You mean you can actually cook bugs?" And now have their own careers. This woman over on the left, that's Daniela Martin. She has a web presence. She does a blog called Girl Meets Bug. The guy on the right, that's Zach Lemon, he works for the Audubon Insectarium in Louisiana. They actually have a kitchen called Bug Appetite. And people, I read in the newspaper that 10,000 people on a busy week will go through there and eat insects. So he's a hard competitor and a hard opponent, and then I've done a couple of demos with him where he's beaten me. How embarrassing to be beaten by a young upstart, but he's a great chef. And the gentleman in the Hawaiian shirt, that's Dave Gracer, he now has his own business. It's called Small Stock Food Solutions, or Small Stock Food Strategies, and he supplies insects. Two of the kinds of insects that we're serving today came from Dave Gracer's resources. Of course, I won. That's me holding the gold trophy. And Dave, who doesn't do a lot of cooking demos, came in fourth. He's holding the stink bug trophy. Stink bugs are interesting animals because they also are considered a delicacy. If you go to Mexico, they have a stink bug festival where everyone's eating stink bugs, and they make a stink bug pate. So I know stink bugs are becoming problematic. There's a non-native species that's being spread throughout the United States. If you can't beat them, eat them. That's my motto. These are gummy tarantulas. I don't know if they still make these. I took this photo several years ago. But we have a lot of kind of fake insect food that's out there. There were ice cream bars at one point that were modeled after the character Pumbaa from The Lion King. He's the warthog, and of course he loves to eat bugs. So they had rubber bugs that went along with those. And this company, these are lollipops. One, the green one is a Cricket Lick-It lollipop. The light green, the pale one, is actually a tequila-flavored sucker with a worm in it. A mealworm in this case. And it's interesting to me, the company that makes these is called Hot Licks. They're in, where else? California. And they have this enormous industry. It's like a big factory and a big warehouse just making novelty suckers with bugs in them. They make all sorts of other novelty foods as well, including little, that looks like amber, little yellow blocks with small scorpions from China. They do chocolate covered ants. When I was really little, there were lots of novelty foods out there. I have these ancient cans of grasshoppers from the 50s. You can actually see they're like stamped on the bottom, but they're processed in occupied Japan, so late 40s actually.
We were at a wedding in central Indiana that served those as the favors.
Ooh.
Okay.
For an outdoor wedding, because nice. The bride and the groom met through Lutheran Outdoor Ministries at camp. And so the wedding was outside at camp, and at the table, everybody had these suckers. And by the time we got to dinner, the lighting wasn't all that good. And a lot of people were munching on their suckers, not knowing.
I've had people, the same kind of thing, where I'm doing cooking demos and I have a plate of cookies. They're white chocolate and waxworm cookies. Some of you from the Midwest would know waxworms are sold as bait. They're actually little white caterpillars. When they're baked, they taste like pistachio nuts. They're really good. But I have people come up, they don't know what I'm talking about. They furtively grab one of the cookies and take off. And then, are they in for a surprise? While I have this slide up here, though, I do want to talk about the bug in the tequila bottle. You know, they always talk about the worm in the tequila. Well, it's actually a caterpillar. And it's not tequila, it's actually mezcal, which is made from a specific plant from Mexico, an agave, a large agave. And the caterpillar that they put in there is proof of two things. First of all, it's proof of authenticity. You only find these caterpillars in mezcal plants, because in the agave plants, because that's where the moths lay these caterpillar eggs. But it's also a proof that the spirit level, the proof of the alcohol, is high enough to preserve the bugs in there. If it was like watered down, you wouldn't be able to walk around with this preserved caterpillar in there. So that's the reason you find the caterpillar in the bottom of a bottle of mezcal. I recently got together with a bunch of other people. You know, this is a growing industry, and a lot of people are looking at insects as human food. We'll talk about that a little further in just a minute. But I brought a bottle of mezcal, and I said, let's see who gets to eat the caterpillar at the bottom, which implies we're going to drink the bottle among us tonight. Well, we didn't get there. But I did get to work out one of my new recipes, because I'm working on a revised and updated Eat a Bug cookbook. And in the revised book, there's going to be 10 new recipes, of course. One of them is chocolate fondue with grasshoppers. So we got to have those, at least, while we drank the mezcal. All right, I know I've been making light of all of this, but it's actually a serious issue right now. The world's population continues to grow. It's gone from 6 billion to 7 billion just in my lifetime. It's going to be growing exponentially. And it's not that unlikely it will be hitting 8 billion soon. And this is actually the cover of a report that was produced by the FAO, which is a branch of the United Nations, Food and Agriculture Organization, I think that stands for. And they held a big conference a few years ago in Chiang Mai, Thailand, attended by people from all over the world, to look at the possibilities of developing, particularly in emerging nations, more of an interest and market in and supply for edible insects. A lot of those cultures are already pretty friendly up to insects. We're not in this culture. We're a nation of bug bashers, basically. So working in these emerging nations to get people a little less dependent on the Big Mac and more dependent on their regional foods, particularly if they can be grown indoors or in some way cultured, so we're not just over-harvesting from the wild. This is what they were looking at this conference. There's actually several different sort of spin-off organizations that have come up since then. And it was interesting for me, because after this report came out, it was almost like a new book all over again. The environmental spin on it started inspiring lots of writers to write about this topic. And I was getting all sorts of phone calls and requests for interviews as the old authority on this topic. What was funny is a restaurant in Vancouver, British Columbia, actually called me up. They said they read this article, it was in the New York Times. They wanted to be environmentally friendly. They were they're probably one of the best Indian restaurants in the world, at least according to the New York Times. There's a line around the block, so they weren't doing this just for publicity. They were doing it out of an adventurous and creative spirit. And they worked with me as a consultant to develop a chapati bread made of cricket flour, which was quite popular. Then people started ordering that. They now are making cricket pizzas as part of their dish. I know it's not traditional Indian food, but it's kind of their cafe food as well. So a lot of life was kicked into the idea of eating insects by this conference and this paper that came out. But even more so, more recently, there was a big report that came out of the Netherlands, done by a university in the Netherlands, and they were looking quite seriously at insects as human food, but they wanted to have a fully integrated program. I love this photograph because there's my book right on the table there. Nice stuff, it's gotten around. And they created this program at the university where they're raising the insects. This is a really good thing because insects can be raised indoors. I mean, you do need some heat, but you don't need the massive quantities of food and water. I have another slide in here, so we'll revisit this. But it's kind of shocking when you think about how many gallons of water go into raising 1 pound of meat. And if everyone started eating Big Macs, I think that's the concern of the FAO. If everyone started eating hamburgers and they have to clear even more land for cattle, then we're starting to get in trouble. Because I think they're saying now we're almost at peak capacity for how much land we really can afford to clear. So getting something that can be raised indoors in massive quantities doesn't require a lot of water. Those mealworms we're talking about, which by the way are not worms, they're actually baby beetles, they require almost no water at all. They get a lot of their water by metabolizing the carbohydrates in grain. If you think about it, they're granary pests. They live in these very, very dry conditions and do quite well, turn into little black beetles in a matter of weeks. So they don't need much water at all. You put 16 pounds of grain into a cow, you get 1 pound of meat. That's not a very good turnover. There are whole villages that could be floated on that level of grain production and wouldn't necessarily even need the cows if they processed it as such. 16-1 is the ratio there. With most insects, it's about 3-1, 3 pounds of grain to 1 pound of meat. So that's a real advantage there. This is a facility, a small facility at that university where they're raising locusts in cages. And here's a gentleman at the same facility making mealworm quiches. The thing that's nice about this is they're actually making these things, freezing them, packaging them, and selling them in delis. So it's a fully integrated program. It's not just sort of this experimental thing. They want to see how this is going to take. And I read quite recently that they now have their own cookbook, too. Thank heavens for my book sales. It's in Dutch, so it hasn't been translated into English yet. But I'm really eager to read it myself. This is my real men do eat quiche photograph here. And here's that graphic showing that the profit margin is what they're really looking at here, but they're also then looking at smaller things in terms of the amount of food goes in. You can see the body weight conversion factor is 13% for cattle. It's 33% for pigs, and it's 60% for grasshoppers. Good deal. Everybody wins. The most amazing thing of the study from the university in Holland and what really caught people's attention, this was news to me, these big feedlots are a big load of pollution. I mean, they're basically all that waste comes out of all those cows held together. It's not the happiest environment for cows either. But I didn't realize this. The statistic was, if we started raising grasshoppers instead of cows, we could actually cut greenhouse gas emissions by 60%. You know, greenhouse gases, those are the different gases in our environment that go up and actually form a layer up in the upper atmosphere and hold in heat. So while we're going through all this, gee, this is the rainiest summer I've ever experienced or whatever, kind of climate change, a lot of that starts with the greenhouse gas layer up in the top. And it doesn't come as much from automobiles. That's what would have been my first guess, you know, smog. No, it's actually coming from cattle flatulence. You know, cattle have those multi-part stomachs. They process, they break down cellulose. They're not very good at it. They have to eat lots and lots of stuff. Yes, it's cattle. We're talking about cow farts, basically. Cow farts and cow poop. That's where most of the methane gas comes from. It goes right up into the upper atmosphere. So the whole notion of, well, we'll just keep raising more and more cows to feed the world's hungry, this is not a good notion at all. If they start cutting back on that, even if we don't suddenly go, all right, no more cows, it's grasshoppers from now on. Let's say you eat meat less. And that's basically what a lot of people are saying, you know, meatless Mondays or what have you. Then you're slowing the pace of methane production, but you're also slowing the pace of land conversion into agricultural lands. This gets to be a great dispute because for at one point I was writing an article about the rate of land conversion in South America, you know, clearing the rainforest to growing cattle. You hear that a lot. In actuality, a lot of that is clearing the land to raise soybeans now. But three guesses where the soybeans go to feed cattle. Same difference. This could be the future for us. That's right. And actually, they're saying, I love this quote. This is from Dave Gracer. He says, eating a cow is like driving an SUV. Eating an insect is like riding a bicycle. So a lot of good environmental smarts in that. The other thing I want to point out is diversification. If we only rely on chicken, beef, or turkey, and for that matter, when we're going out fishing, we only go for the big stuff, salmon and halibut, we're going to run out of those things. We're putting an incredible amount of pressure on the wild stocks of fish, throwing away a lot of other stuff. And there was one time, I remember, shortly before the Olympics in China, they had an email that went around with lots of pictures of the weird foods you could buy in Chinese markets. They included some pretty harsh ones like dog liver, but they also had lots of photos of bugs. When I looked at that picture, I went, you know, this is actually not a bad idea. If everyone in China suddenly started eating chicken sandwiches, or pork, that feed pressure on those feedlots would be incredible. But by diversifying, by eating lots of different sources of protein, we're respectively putting a lot less pressure on the planet as human beings, as a species. So This may look shocking to us now, but let's check back in 20 years. People are incredibly slow to trying new foods. Look at sushi bars. 30 years ago, they were almost non-existent. Now you can go out and spend your paycheck at one. And they're all over the place, even in places I wouldn't think had any access to ocean. The same thing could be true about bugs. Right now, it's a novelty, something you find in lollipops, or maybe in some delis in the Netherlands. But there are people working at this very minute on energy bars, like hiker bars, made with a cricket flour. In fact, I just saw a little Kickstarter thing, you know, those where you can go and contribute online to getting those programs started. They have a Kickstarter program to help support that. There's another company that's looking at insect protein. They just got a Gates Foundation grant, $100,000 grant, to develop an infant food for some of these people in emerging nations where they really have a lot of infant mortality because of the nutritional issues. So more and more of this is happening. It's hard to predict at what pace it'll grow, particularly when you look at a lot of the hostility that most of us have for insects. Insects, oh yuck, aren't they germy and gross and disgusting? Well, if we didn't have insects, we wouldn't have a lot of the life on our planet through their pollination services, their food for other animals, their garbage disposal systems by breaking down food as decomposers. That's an important thing. So I always like to challenge people about being entomophobes, you know, insect fear people, and probably the best way to challenge them is by inviting them to dine. So let's take a few questions, and then I'm going to invite you all to come up and dine. Anybody have some questions? Yes, sir.
Now, are there different types of flours? You talked about cricket flours. Do you see more other flours that are processed and then put into food?
You know, I think that's the thing. Quite realistically, if they said this product contains insects, people will freak out. Did any of you see the big flap about Starbucks Frappuccinos? They're colored, strawberry Frappuccinos were colored with a red dye that actually comes from insects. You know, it's like one minute element in their red food coloring. I'd rather have red number 4. Which comes from a chemistry set, right? Natural product that's been used for centuries. Navajo blankets are dyed red. But with that, it's called cochineal or carmine. The British redcoats dyed red from that same stuff. It's been in use for, you know, centuries. And people are freaking because it comes from insects. So I think when they actually have flour like that or any other product, it'll probably say animal protein. They won't tell you what animals, but it'll probably say animal protein and leave it at that to warn off vegetarians. So yeah, there are a lot of, you know, there's a movement worldwide in looking at sort of the heritage grains. Quinoa is a great one. A lot of these different grains that were used in other cultures, millet, things like that, not just the ones we use over and over. Wheat, more people have wheat allergies now than ever before. So I'm thinking that a lot of these other protein additives will start coming into the picture too. Anybody else? Yeah.
I'm just curious how bug food safety compares with meat, the kinds of traditional meat food safety things we have. And especially if you're talking about commercial production, because you get a lot more, you know, food safety issues when you, you know, grow beef in feedlots than when you have pasture-fed beef. And how is it for bugs? Like, does the meat last longer? Is it more prone to bacterial infection or less prone to bacterial infection?
You know, this is a really good question, and I think the answers are coming forth nowadays, because there hasn't been that much of an interest in mass-producing insects for anything other than pet food. I mean, I tell people, like in this group, if you want to try these recipes at home, go to Petco or PetSmart. You can buy crickets there. You can buy mealworms. Only recently are people starting to raise these animals in large scale for people and have to look at some of those controls as well. But generally speaking, I'm kind of with you. I think it's always a question of scale. And, you know, a salmon farm that had 5 salmon in it, fine, that sounds great. When you have hundreds of them crammed in the pens, that's when you start having problems with viruses and parasites and things like that. So I'm hoping that they'll keep that well worked out. But I should also mention, because I have to get into these battles whenever I do programs in other states and get a health department who's very curious. I'm going to digress a little bit because my favorite health department story, I did a program in Seattle, outdoors in front of Safeco Field, the stadium, and the health department chimed in and said, well, if you're cooking outdoors, you need to cook under a canopy so that bugs don't get in. True story, ladies and gentlemen. But I do have, kind of have to go back and forth with the health departments sometimes. I was banned in Boston one year. And I actually found that one of the cricket farms in Louisiana is actually producing USDA certified crickets. And that's because they have to be certified to go into the those lollipops and other novelty foods. So there are ways of in putting a good health department scrutiny on these products, just like there are for any other meat, what we say, conventional protein sources. And I'm sure those will happen. A lot of times when I do cooking demonstrations and the health department shows up, everybody goes, oh no, they're freaking because we're going to be serving scorpions. What the health department really wants to make sure is, if you're going to be serving the public, is there a sneeze guard like at a salad bar? Or do you have an open container of milk? They're way more concerned about human germs being passed through the food than they are about any germs that were brought in by the bugs themselves. Let's eat. All right, so today I have two different delicacies, and we have plenty of each. I only got a head start on one of them. One of the dishes we're going to serve is crackers with cream cheese, and I love this name. These are big-bottomed ants. They're from, these actually were collected in Texas, but in Colombia, these ants, they're called, let me think I remember the name for that. Oh, it'll come to me when I'm not thinking. But it translates out as big-bottomed ants. These are the queens that emerge at certain times of the year. They're much larger than the rest of the kind of leaf cutter ant. Hormigas colones, it means big bottomed ants. And they have very large bottoms because they're going to go out and start laying eggs if they find the right spot. They also have wings, so I'll tell you, when you're ready to eat the ants, if you don't want to eat the wings, which is like a little bit of cellophane, pull those off. I didn't really have time in setting up today to prepare them that way. So we're having crackers with cream cheese and ants. That's what I was telling you when we were in Times Square and the Colombians were coming by. They were going, oh, free food. Having a great time. Try those. But we're also going to be making one, we're also going to be serving one of the dishes that Time Magazine called my signature dish. It's called Orthopteran Orzo. And it's orzo pasta with red and green peppers and a little bit of onion, lightly seasoned, because I don't want the seasoning to get in the way of everyone tasting it. And the other ingredient are cricket nymphs. These are our oven-baked crickets from one of the USDA-certified suppliers. We're going to mix those in right now, and I invite you to come up. Be polite, no pushing and shoving now. Take a fork and a little spoon and or a little bowl, and we'll serve you some of the Orthopteran Orzo and help yourselves to a cracker. Thank you very much, and bug everybody.